This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and it's January 2022. Do you know your COVID status? Are you vaccinated?
Boosted?
Even if you're both. Have you had a COVID test recently?
Were you negative?
Well, what kind of test was it?
Was it positive?
Do you have any symptoms? If you do have symptoms, are you just feeling crummy? Or are you alarmed by just how sick you're feeling? This is January 2022. And are you any more confident about what you know about COVID? Or are you, like so many of us right here on The Takeaway, feeling confused, nervous, and just plain exhausted as we continue to navigate the disruptions and mourn the deaths of the still raging COVID-19 pandemic? About 63% of people in the U.S. are now vaccinated, and the vaccines are overwhelmingly effective at preventing severe cases of COVID-19. But as Omicron surges, I'm willing to bet that all of us know people, both vaccinated and unvaxxed, or we ourselves have fallen ill or gotten a positive test in recent weeks. And with nearly 2,000 people dying each and every day from COVID in this country, we are most certainly not in a post-COVID moment. Dr. Anthony Fauci has been a familiar face and a consistent companion throughout this long journey. Having served during both the Trump administration and now the Biden administration, Dr. Fauci is the now familiar face and voice of American public health. It's a position that's also made him a favorite target of derision for some on the right, as was on full display last week during his tense exchange with Senator Rand Paul.
You really think it's appropriate to use your $420,000 salary to attack scientists that disagree with you?
Senator, you are distorting everything about me.
This wasn't the only time.
You are making a catastrophic epidemic for your political gain.
Far happier than Senator Paul, I was pleased to welcome Dr. Fauci, the chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden, to The Takeaway. And we began by talking about last week's Supreme Court decision, which struck down the Biden administration's mandate that companies with more than 100 employees require their workers to get vaccinated.
Well, it certainly is very disappointing because we still have, you know, literally tens of millions of people. We have 63% of the country is vaccinated, which means 37% is not fully vaccinated. And among adults, 28% are not vaccinated, and that's a lot of people. And we're still having a very serious surge, as we all are now aware, of SARS-CoV-2, particularly the Omicron variant. And we're having, you know, 156,000 people hospitalized. We had about 800,000 cases on an average over the last 14 days, and we have close to 2,000 deaths. I mean, we really need to get more people vaccinated, and that's the reason why this decision is really quite disappointing, as we want to get as many people vaccinated and protected and vaccinated and boosted as we possibly can.
So Dr. Fauci, I want to dig into the response you just gave, because you did what I think has become very natural for many of us over the course of the past 2 years when we're trying to think about where we are in any given moment in this pandemic, which is to look at the rate and number of positive cases, to look at the hospitalizations, to look at the number of deaths. And yet, Omicron seems to be different in some important ways from earlier variants. So just help me to understand. What are the relevant numbers we should be considering?
Yeah, the relevant numbers are the hospitalizations and the deaths. There's no doubt, if you look at the number of hospitalizations per number of cases, in other words, the percentage of cases that get hospitalized, if you look at the seriousness of the cases, if you look at the duration of time in a hospital, and if you look at, for example, requirements for ventilation or for assisted ventilation. We're seeing that in South Africa, in the UK, and we're seeing it, the beginning of it right now in the United States, that there's no doubt that on a person-to-person basis, the Omicron variant is not as severe as Delta. The only problem is that Omicron is so much more transmissible than the other variants that by sheer volume of cases, you are going to get a lot of hospitalizations and a lot of deaths. So it's that thing that you don't want to confuse people, because you don't want them to be overconfident and complacent and say, well, it's not as severe. But you say, but wait a minute, if you get 50 people that get infected and 10% of them get hospitalized, let's say, that means there are 5 people that are hospitalized. But if you get 500 people who are infected, even though 1% of them are hospitalized, you still have a lot of hospitalized people. So even though it's inherently a less severe variant, the total number of people who are getting infected are leading to the average of, you know, almost 2,000 deaths and having 157,000 people in the hospital right now. So those are numbers that need to be taken very seriously, even though inherently we're dealing with a less severe virus.
We tend to discuss the unvaccinated as though it is primarily about vaccine hesitancy or boosting hesitancy. How much of this, however, is still about vaccine and booster access?
Well, I don't think it's any problem. It might have been some time ago. Right now, if you look at access and take a look, for example, among minority populations. Right now, if you look at the percent people at various ages among African-American, Hispanics, other members of the population, it's virtually equivalent. We're falling a little bit behind on the people who are vaccinated and getting boosted when you talk about disparities in ethnic and racial. But I don't think one can say that vaccines are not easily accessible. Vaccines are highly available, they're highly effective, they're safe, and they're free. So I don't think one can invoke access. You could say people are not inherently hesitant because they still feel issues about safety or issues about do they really work. And that's the reason why you try to get as much information that's correct information out there. The problem that one deals with when you're dealing with social media is that there's so much misinformation and disinformation about vaccines that sometimes confuses people who are not really sure what the correct information is. But if you look at the track record of the vaccines globally, not only in the United States, they're highly effective and they're very safe. If you look at the effect of proper mask wearing, there's no doubt there are so many studies now. A year and a half, 2 years ago, there weren't as many studies, but the studies that are coming out now continually show the high efficacy of masks in protecting you from getting infected, as well as preventing you from infecting others.
Now, vaccine access may be much less of a problem, but testing access is clearly still an issue. I know that the administration has moved forward with accessibility of some home testing, but this hasn't gone particularly well. Can you talk a little bit more about testing access?
Yeah, well, certainly you're correct. Up until recently, and literally is going to change very, very quickly, the president himself have said in a press conference that I was with him at, that we needed to do better, that there's a huge demand, unprecedented demand for tests with the Omicron surge, as well as around the holiday season when people were traveling and understandably and appropriately wanted to get tested. But right now, that is being corrected, because on January 19th, we'll be seeing literally a half a billion tests starting to go out free to individuals. There'll be another half a billion soon thereafter. There'll be a website in which individuals can get on the website and have tests delivered to their home free. And then there'll be many, many more tests that will be available at 20,000 testing sites throughout the country. So you are correct, and there's no denying that we could have done better with testing, but that should improve dramatically very, very soon, literally within days.
Now, as you were talking about the challenge of battling misinformation, it made me think about the fact that you just had some recent, very tense exchanges with Republican senators Rand Paul, Roger Marshall. And public health has become very politicized over the course of the past 2 years. I'm wondering if you currently consider particular ideologies, individuals, maybe even full media outlets, or perhaps the entire Republican Party to be a threat to public health.
No, I'm not going to be saying that. You know where that will go if I say that. I think you just have to look at what's going on out there vis-a-vis the states and regions that are under-vaccinated. I mean, obviously, unfortunately, that's along ideologic lines, which is really, really unfortunate, because this should not be a political issue. We have a common enemy here, and a common enemy is the virus. And to have decisions about sound public health principles be dictated by ideology or by political persuasion is just very counterproductive to having a successful effort to really counter this historic pandemic.
Now, Dr. Fauci, we do have some calls from listeners, so I want to play a few of them for you. Each one is pretty brief.
Justin calling from Brooklyn. I have a message for Dr. Fauci. I personally don't have HIV, but I know people who does. Does the coronavirus take all the resources from looking a cure for HIV?
I mean, certainly COVID has dominated the global scene. And because of the disruptions, for example, of supply chain of drugs and of testing for other diseases, whether that's a mammogram for breast cancer or a colonoscopy to look to prevent colon cancer, or getting people tested for HIV and on appropriate therapy, or getting pre-exposure prophylaxis. We've tried very hard not to have that disruption in the service for HIV, for persons with HIV or at risk for HIV, as best as we could. But there have been some disruptions. I'm particularly sensitive about that because I've spent the bulk of my 50-year career and the last 41 years of my professional career very deeply involved and committed to HIV research and the care of individuals living with HIV. So that question is particularly meaningful to me, and that's the reason why we try our best not to have any disruptions in the care or accessibility of care for people living with HIV.
We've got a call here around masks from Katrina.
My name is Katrina. I'm calling from Wichita, Kansas. It seems to me like the whole point of wearing a mask is to keep other people from becoming sick if you have COVID, whether you realize you have it or not. But I feel like the more socially accepted view about wearing a mask is that it's there to keep you safe from other people. And so the question, I guess, basically just has to do with the idea of, like, if I'm in a room full of people who are very sick with COVID and I have a mask on of a very high quality, will I get sick? Thank you.
Yeah. That's an excellent question. And the answer is simple. It goes both ways. There was some question about that some time ago. But right now, it's very clear that a high quality, well-fitted mask, if used properly, not only will prevent you if you are infected from spreading it to someone else, but it will protect you from getting infected if you are surrounded by people who are infected, even people who have no symptoms, who you don't know that they're infected, as well as someone who you actually, it's obvious that they're infected. So it's a both way protection.
And our final call, Dr. Fauci, is on a bit of a lighter note. It's a very empathetic call from Alana.
Hi, this is Alana from Encinitas, California. I would really like to know what Dr. Fauci's self-care routine is.
Well, thank you so much for that question. Unfortunately, given the stress and the strain and the intensity of what is going on, I think I've lapsed a bit on my self-care, as you call it. Unfortunately, I don't have much time to be concerned about self-care because there are so many challenges out there to get this outbreak under control. But thank you so much for asking. I appreciate your concern.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden, and he needs a little time for self-care. Dr. Fauci, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Gwen from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I want Dr. Fauci to know that everybody I know is incredibly grateful for his agreeing to stay on and continue working tirelessly on behalf of all of us when he had every right to just walk off into the sunset for a well-deserved retirement after navigating administration after administration, guiding us through HIV, H1N1, Ebola. So please know that we appreciate you, Dr. Fauci, and all of the public health practitioners working to keep us safe despite all of the louder voices of the political rants and social media hype.
Thank you.
Let's take another perspective about the Biden administration's handling of the pandemic from Professor Stephen Thrasher, who's professor at Northwestern University and author of the forthcoming book, The Viral Underclass. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, so you let the Biden administration have it in your recent piece for The Guardian. Part of what you say is that the Biden administration has failed its COVID test. Why is that your assessment?
We've had an extremely vaccine-specific approach to the pandemic over the past year or so, and the Biden administration has really failed to look forward in ways that they should have. So we're just now getting news that there are going to be home tests sent. They've promised $1 billion, which is only 3 per American. That's not nearly enough. And they're not going to start coming until next month. Now, it's great that they're creating a culture of testing. I think everyone should have these tests in their medicine cabinet, like a thermometer, so that they're always there for your use when you need it. It is annoying that they're making it go through a website. They could have just sent them all through the Postal Service. And they keep coming back to kind of a sense of personal responsibility for everyone. Now, of course, it's important that people do get their vaccines, but even at a pretty high vaccination rate, we're still seeing lots of breakthrough cases. That doesn't mean the vaccines aren't working. They're doing part of what they're supposed to do, but they're just being bombarded by way too much virus to be as effective as they can be. And the Biden administration has failed to take other mitigating actions when they've needed to. They have really resisted shutting things down. Democratic and Republican governors and mayors around the country have resisted doing shutdowns, certainly paid lockdowns, when we've needed to have circuit breaks to let less virus come into being. And then they just really, really failed to look forward to the need to get these home tests to people before the holidays and also to get high quality masks. I think Axios had a scoop last night that they said the Biden administration is going to start to give away masks, but they haven't yet. And all of this needed to be planned last summer, looking forward to when inevitably more virus would develop as people came indoors together at the holidays. And they really failed to do that. They're acting completely retroactively right now.
Yeah, I do want to confirm that story that you just mentioned, which is that the Biden administration is going to be making these KN95 and K95 masks available through pharmacies, sort of part of that big stockpile that the government had. My dog is very excited about it, apparently. But I also want to sort of come on this question around sort of the timing, and maybe particularly this kind of what you almost describe as like a holiday stumble, right? It's basically right around the Thanksgiving holiday that we learn about Omicron. And then it's somehow January before we respond, as though sort of there was a kind of sleepiness about it during the December holidays.
There definitely was. They're just kind of playing catch up when we count on our public health professionals and government officials to be looking forward. It was always predictable from multiple social scientists about what vaccine hesitancy would be like, and among all kinds of scientists, that there were going to be mutations. And so we need them to look forward, and they didn't do that. And even as they would say, you know, Google where to find a test, so many people simply could not find tests. I had a cousin who waited online 7 hours for a test, and that's a poll tax of people's time when they're having to do that. And many people just simply could not find them. Many people can't get these masks. And again, I'm glad that they're finally going to make them available. But I was laughing about a story last night that my good friend E. Tammy Kim wrote in the New York Times 2 full years ago almost about how South Korea had been making these masks available to their population. We've continuously, you know, had many advantages of time and money in the United States with this virus. If we would look to what countries were doing in Asia from almost 2 years ago, we could see lots of the blueprints that we've failed to pick up. And it's been particularly frustrating because more people have now died under the Biden administration than died under the Trump administration, despite having the vaccine. And so it's been really disappointing that the administration that claims to follow the science is not doing so when it's going to cost money to business.
All right, Steve, I'm going to pause just on that one number. I will say the production team and I were like digging into that number about the same number or more. And it's there is a little bit of a challenge here around like apples to apples around timing, but there is certainly no doubt that over time, I mean, either the Biden administration, there have been as many people who have died sort of right now, about the same number, or there will certainly be more because he's going to be president during COVID longer. But I get your point that he's also president during COVID during a time when we do have vaccines available. And I'm wondering, part of what you really point to in this piece is this notion of social and economic divides. And you remind us of a time around the HIV crisis as well. And this notion of sort of who is hardest hit by this point of the pandemic.
Yeah, so certainly, as Dr. Fauci was saying, he's been a central figure in the past four decades of AIDS research and the government's response to it. And something I come to often in my classes and my own thinking is how more people did die after HIV medications were available than before there were no medicines. And the major point of that, that I think is not an apples to apples blame, but a very lethal reminder that pharmacological interventions alone do not end pandemics. We have to deal with all kinds of other social things. So for people like myself who primarily work from home, it's great to have a home test. And I'm glad that I'm able to order it online. I was able to help an elderly friend order it. But the people who are actually doing face-to-face work, who had to go out and stand in those lines, they not only lost time, they could have been earning money or resting from the kind of shift work they do. They're also being exposed again when they're going, you know, indoors into a testing site, whereas the government could have just sent these masks to everyone. It could have sent tests to everyone and allowed people to test themselves at home before they gathered the families and friends. And then one of the major things that we have to be concerned about is that incarceration is a major driver of this pandemic. And the Biden administration has not, and many Democratic mayors and governors have not, you know, reduced prison populations and jail populations, which are one of the reasons why so much virus keeps moving within them. And particularly with county jails, people going for short periods and then going back into their communities and taking the virus with them.
Yeah, folks, do not miss that. More than 600,000 people every single day released from American prisons and jails. And if we're not controlling the virus in those spaces, we are not controlling the virus in our general population. Dr. Stephen Thrasher is a professor at Northwestern University and author of The Viral Underclass. That's coming out in August. As always, thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Welcome back to The Takeaway, where we continue our discussion of the current realities of the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, every morning I go through the list of patients and I say, okay, who needs to be vaccinated? We offer vaccinations, and it's very rare anybody says no. These are not anti-vaxxers. These are people who have barriers to accessing healthcare, who have some reasons for disorganization in their lives, where this is perhaps not the first priority. And so we really do need to figure out, how do you reach out to those populations and recognize not every unvaccinated person is against vaccination.
That's Dr. Celine Goundar, infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City. Dr. Goundar joined The Takeaway recently and stopped our whole production team in our tracks when we heard her evoke vaccine access rather than vaccine hesitancy as an important reason some communities remain so vulnerable and unvaccinated. So when Dr. Fauci stopped by The Takeaway, I asked him if he thought vaccine access remained part of the explanation for why some Americans still haven't had that shot.
We're falling a little bit behind on the people who are vaccinated and getting boosted when you talk about disparities in ethnic and racial. But I don't think one can say that vaccines are not easily accessible. Vaccines are highly available, they're highly effective, they're safe, and they're free.
According to the Mayo Clinic's vaccine tracker, nearly 63% of Americans have had at least two doses of Pfizer or Moderna or one dose of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Another 12% of Americans are at least partially vaccinated. So what's going on with everybody else? Is it hesitancy? Is it accessibility? And with rapidly spreading Omicron variant, just how exposed are we all? Rachel Hardiman is the Blue Cross Endowed Professor of Health and Racial Equity and Founding Director of the Center for Anti-Racism Research for Health Equity at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Welcome to The Takeaway, Rachel.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
All right, so let's just start with this. How important is access right now relative to our unvaccinated rates?
So I think access is incredibly important, but I think about access a little bit differently than how Dr. Fauci described it, which is, you know, simply saying that they're available, they're free, they're safe, right? So it's not just an issue of access being availability, but if access, you know, doesn't also include the right knowledge and education, if access doesn't include the right or the trusted provider to administer the vaccine, if access doesn't include time away from work, paid leave, if side effects or reactions to the vaccine happen, then we can't say we truly have access. And so I think that's sort of the crux of the issue, is that there's a lot of other barriers surrounding vaccine access that we haven't addressed to truly make them accessible in communities, and particularly in communities of color.
Dr. Hardiman, is there an example of a place where access on all the different fronts that you have identified there seems to actually have moved the vaccination needle?
I don't know that I can name a specific place, right? So we certainly see that there are states that are doing really well with their vaccination rates. You know, states like Vermont, for instance, it's doing an excellent job. But and then there's other states, you know, particularly in the South, that are lagging behind. I think there's little pockets of communities across the country where, you know, there are incredible leaders, community physicians, church leaders, and things like that, who are really improving access for the folks that they serve in their community. And I think that those efforts are the ones that have to be commended when we talk about improving access and really having those critical conversations with folks about why vaccination is important.
So my husband and I were joking this morning that if you kind of look at a scale in our community, which is a Southern community and a pretty religious one, that at the top is, you know, God, Jesus, the church. And then next is the principal of our school. Because the principal of our school has managed, you know, throughout the past 2 years to be a great communicator about what's going on, to keep parents up to date, to make good choices, and quite honestly, to keep our little independent school open for nearly every day of this, you know, once we went back in the fall after that very first pivot. And so that sense of like a trusted local person, I absolutely get. But I'll also say it's a community of relative privilege, of parents and principal who speak the same language in terms of education, all of that kind of thing. What happens when you have to have those communication points around vaccines where there isn't that kind of similarity?
We actually live in a very similar scenario to the one that you just described, right? Where our daughter and the head of her school has done an incredible job of communicating and messaging and building trust right within our community. But there's so many areas and so many pockets of and communities where that's not the case. And that's where we have a lot of work to do. And it also means that we have to be thinking about not just COVID and not just COVID vaccination, but how other social factors and social determinants are impacting both health and well-being, but also the day-to-day lives and how people sort of operate with different systems and different institutions, whether it's healthcare or education, and thinking about sort of all those points where people are accessing information and systems and leverage that to build relationships. And that takes time. And I think some would argue, well, we don't have time. People just need to sort of suck it up and get the shot. But it's really a matter of taking a step back and having those conversations, finding out the why. You know, so many people have a story behind perhaps why they haven't been vaccinated. For some, it may simply be that they weren't offered a vaccine. For others, we hear a lot of this sort of wait and see mentality. Well, this felt like it was rolled out really quickly. I just want to wait a few more months and see what happens. And so being able to respect that, to have those conversations and to talk about vaccination without shaming people, I think is incredibly important.
Now, there's some specific communities, those who are without homes, those who are without internet access, and those who are without citizenship or legal status documentation. How do we close the gap around vaccination for those communities?
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of work happening in cities across the country where outreach to unhoused folks is has been an incredibly important initiative and is gaining some success around the country, which is great. You know, I think the challenges with those who don't have citizenship, who are undocumented, who have that fear of engaging with our systems is a bigger challenge. And that means we have to have trusted, you know, community health workers and community leaders who can say, this is safe. We don't require any of your information. We just want to make sure that you are able to live a healthy life and have access to the things that you need. And I think that requires going into community with the folks who are already there, right? And really engaging folks who know and are trusted within the community to do that work. You know, I think the same, we're seeing the same with language barriers as well, and really being intentional about how we message, create messaging in different languages to reach out to communities in culturally appropriate ways.
So let's talk for a second about data. I feel like the past 2 years must be an extraordinary moment of data collection. Not all of it could possibly have all been analyzed yet with the speed at which it's coming in. So how comprehensive and reliable are data right now, particularly about those harder to count communities and their vaccination rates?
There has been a huge push over the past couple of years. I mean, really since the pandemic began, to make sure that we were not just collecting data, but being able to collect the racial and ethnicity data that is necessary to understand if a disproportionate burden of COVID-19 was falling upon certain communities. And the same goes for vaccination as well. I think we have certainly made strides since 2 years ago or even a year ago when vaccines were rolled out, but we still have a long ways to go to really say that we have robust data for each state. So in most cases, I would say about 75% of the data around race and ethnicity and vaccine rates is accurate. We have even more issues when it comes to understanding the data for vaccination rates for kids, for instance, between the ages of 5 and 11. Right now, the CDC doesn't actually report race and ethnicity for vaccinated children. And so, you know, the data is incredibly important. I always say we can't change what we don't measure. Right. And so by measuring these things and asking these questions, that allows us to, as you said, you really dig into these pockets of communities that need more help, that need access, or need access in a different way than perhaps we've been typically defining it. And so the data is critical for us to be able to intervene in those ways.
I'm wondering at this moment also just about the questions of sort of collective social pressure. So, you know, when I think about barriers to access, as a political scientist, my first thought is always the ballot box, right? Polling. And one of the things that helps folks get over that and find a way past a lot of really tough barriers is this sense of, like, you know, collective push. We are all going to vote. Come on, folks, here we go. And linking it to identity. I'm wondering if there are ways that the anti-vaccine hesitation actually does create an access problem for those who might not normally be hesitant, but where there might be social pressure not to get vaccinated.
I am not a political scientist, but I do think that we are seeing some of that, right? But certainly there's a politicization, right, of vaccination. And you even can see that in the way that sort of the states rank among vaccinations. So some of the least vaccinated states are states that voted, for instance, for Trump in the 2020 presidential election. And I think that's no coincidence, right? So there's folks who have jumped on this bandwagon and decided, you know, I'm anti-vax. But we also have folks who just need some time to really think this through and have opportunities to access information. And what we've seen actually over the past couple of weeks is that more people have begun to initiate that first dose. It's certainly slowed down now, but I think the Omicron surge actually sort of pushed people along that pathway. And so some of it is messaging around sort of the urgency of Omicron and this sort of collective responsibility that we're all in this together and we need to keep the people who can't get vaccinated safe, you know, especially the little ones under 5 years old. And so, you know, I think that there is a lot to be said for this sort of collective action and this collective power, but also it only gets us so far, unfortunately.
I'm also really interested in how this might be showing up in the medical community. So, you know, we know a lot about sort of long-term social determinants of health and the ways that, you know, sometimes physicians, nurses, medical community will look at Black bodies, at non-English speaking patients, and will, you know, make certain assumptions. And I'm wondering, in this time of, you know, COVID really burdening hospitals and care workers, if there's actually a similar kind of almost discriminatory or a stereotyping going on with folks who are not vaccinated and present in hospital with a serious COVID illness. And if that has any effect ultimately on what happens next in their cases, as we know it does with, you know, with racial discrimination, for example.
I think that the jury is still out. Certainly we hear some anecdotal stories around discrimination and certainly racism in with respect to accessing COVID-19 care during the hospitalization phase. But I think there's a lot still to be learned around the stigma around being unvaccinated and what that means when it intersects with race and ethnicity or other marginalized identities. So it's hard to say right now, but certainly given what we know about how healthcare systems operate, the impact of, you know, racism and discrimination in healthcare delivery, I think it's an area that needs a lot more sort of research and inquiry to be able to dig out what's going on there.
Now, when we think about the responsibility for equity, who is ultimately responsible? Is that CDC? Is that the Biden administration? Is that local government? Is that Walgreens? who should we be looking to here for solutions?
I always say, as a health equity researcher, as an anti-racist researcher, health equity and equity is all of our responsibility. And so I think it's important to think about it from that, you know, even as everyday citizens, you know, asking the question of how can I create equity when it comes to COVID exposure, meaning, you know, wear your mask and wear a good mask, right? Making sure you're socially distanced, making sure you're staying home when you're sick. But, you know, on a bigger picture, it's the responsibility of course, the Biden administration, of the CDC, and of the states and cities and our local leaders to really ensure that we make decisions that lead with equity. And what that means is that everyone has the opportunity to attain their highest level of health. It means that we are allocating resources according to need and not just giving everyone the same thing, right? So I think a perfect example is the recent rollout of, you know, sending COVID-19 antigen tests to homes, right? So the question is, what about those who live in multi-generational households where, you know, you only get these four tests that go to one address? That's not going to be enough for many of our communities of color, many of our low-income communities where there are multiple families living in the same home or under the same address. And so thinking about how equity plays a role there and really leading the decision-making and the policy-making with that equity lens is incredibly important.
Rachel Hardman is the founding director of the Center for Anti-Racism Research for Health Equity at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Professor Hardman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Discuss postpartum depression or the baby blues, it's typically linked to the experiences of women and birthing parents who are managing both the physiological changes of pregnancy and childbirth and the complicated familial, social, and emotional challenges of new parenting. But not all parents give birth to their children. Dads in heterosexual partnerships, adoptive families, dual moms, dual dads, single dads, intended parents in surrogacy. Listen, there are a lot of ways to make a family. But no matter the pathway to parenting, taking home a tiny new human can prove surprisingly stressful, emotionally and physically. Dads and other non-birthing parents can also feel exhausted, confused, anxious, and isolated in the early months of parenting. Somewhere, I imagine a brand new mom is trying to get her little one to nurse so that she can sit back and enjoy a few minutes of the takeaway. And mama, I feel you. This is not necessarily a moment when you want to hear how hard it is for dear old dad. But wait, don't turn the dial. Now, of course, if you're nursing, you probably can't even reach your radio. But don't tell your smart speaker to turn us off. Because even though there have been fewer studies of paternal mental health after the birth of a new baby, existing research does show that meaningful proportions of dads experience depression, anxiety, and stress in the early months of the parenting journey. And sad dads can struggle with bonding and attachment. Ayman Ismail is a staff writer at Slate, and I talked to him about an article he wrote about his own recent experience with his newborn baby. When Ayman first brought his son home, he thought he was prepared to be a father. He'd read all the baby books. He'd even printed out charts to help him keep track of how much his baby was eating, sleeping, and pooping. They're color-coded, by the way. And he thought he had it all figured out until that first night home from the hospital.
The baby did not do any of that. It was surreal. Like, the baby wasn't eating when he was supposed to be eating. He was supposed to be eating like 12 times on the first day. And the baby only ate like 4 or 5. And so I was thinking in my head, oh my God, this baby's starving. This baby must be like dying of thirst for milk. And so I told my wife, I was like, look, we got to be feeding him more. And I wish I said it like that, because at this point I'd already been panicked. And I was like, the baby's dying. We have to feed him. Oh my God. And, you know, meanwhile, my wife is much more in tune with life than I am. I'm like a nerdy journalist. I spend all my time on the computer. She's more real. So meanwhile, while I'm freaking out, she's just trying to hold her baby, study it, you know, learn from him what he wants, pick up on his cues. And I've got my charts. I've like printed out these things. I don't have a stapler. So there's just papers all over the place. And it was a disaster. I think I'd gotten in my own head. I told myself that in order to be a good dad, I needed to have done all of this extra labor, and all this extra labor was in service of this kid, but not just in service of this kid, it was in service of me. Like, I needed to present myself as an active and healthy and productive dad. And I think that it just got to my head in a very terrible way. It all kind of accumulated in this one moment where it was like the first night, you know, it only been like 8 hours. My wife was sitting there breastfeeding, and the baby wouldn't latch, which is like a very common thing. But at that time, I thought we were like the only ones who had this problem. So I was trying to force feed the baby formula, which we had gotten from the hospital. But my wife was very keen on figuring this out, because it's so important that a mom and a baby connect in this way. And, you know, for people who don't know, there's so much biology that goes into this. Like, the baby's saliva tells the mom what kind of milk to produce. And if she doesn't start feeding the baby right away, it could create problems down the line with how much production is going. There's so much in it, right, that a dad will never be able to biologically understand. But I thought I did, because I read the books. Anyways, I was trying to feed the baby formula because I just thought that he was hungry and that he was crying because he was hungry and that I needed to feed him. And I was very aggressive about it. I've never been aggressive in my life over anything. And she was panicked. I saw it in her eyes. You know, she's a very cool, very chilled person. But I saw this look in her eye that told me, who are you? I don't recognize you. Are you going to be like this forever? Am I stuck with this monster of a husband who's going to be torturing me while I just try and feed my baby? And that was the moment where it hit me like a punch in the chest, where I was like, I have to protect her and the baby from me. And that was a very hard pill to swallow, but I decided that I needed to just remove myself from the situation. It was the summertime, baby was born in June. So I went outside to go tend to my garden and water my plants and prune. And I came back like a half hour later and everything was fine. Nothing had fallen apart. The baby wasn't starving to death. It was fine. And I think seeing that changed my composition for what a good father is supposed to look like. I learned that I needed to play a much more supportive role, to read the room better, to not panic because my baby's not doing exactly what a book said that he would do. And yeah, it was earth-shattering, and it was one of the most painful experiences of my life to see my wife cry.
After the first night of fear and anxiety, Ayman sought out support from friends who were fathers, but he didn't seem to get any solace in those conversations.
He would not, I couldn't get any problems out of him. I pried, and I was like, look, there had to be something that was trouble. Did you at any point put your head in your hands and say, this is tough, I can't do this, I need help? And he was like, no. I was like, I don't believe you. Having a kid is so hard.
And through his new journey into fatherhood, Eamon discovered that a lot of his anxiety stemmed from his own internalization of masculinity and what it means to be a good dad.
The weirdest thing that I've noticed is that I've been in so many crazy situations and in so many crazy circumstances. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey in the 90s, which is a very scary place to be in the 90s. And I was never rattled. You know, I'm a journalist now. I'm a Muslim journalist, and I made it my job to talk to Trump supporters who think that I cheered on 9/11. I was at the Capitol riot as a journalist taking pictures. I followed the Trump supporters in, wasn't rattled. I was in Egypt during the Arab Spring and covered the Muslim Brotherhood while they were protesting, wasn't rattled. This baby was born and all of a sudden I have no composure. I had totally lost my cool. I don't know what to do. I'm a deer stuck in the headlights. I think a part of it comes from the fact that we as men are sort of role modelless in this new generation where it was maybe more acceptable one generation ago to be only concerned with work and a little bit more removed, where the idea of feeding and taking care of the baby was very much considered to be the woman's job. You know, that's something that I discovered in conversations that I've had with my dad and other people's dads, is that they didn't really feel like they had to change diapers unless it was some sort of extraordinary circumstance. My dad very candidly told me that he never once fed me a bottle. And I was like, okay, cool. So my mom did all of that. Interesting. And one of the things that surprised me about that was how alien it felt to me, and I'm only one generation removed, and how different and fast the culture is moving. And so the ideas that still permeate in our culture that men are negligent, they want to have their man cave, they don't really want to be part of the family, it's more of a burden for them. They say things like, well, don't forget who's putting a roof over your head, you know, like crazy stuff like that. And I don't want to be anything like that. In fact, I want to be the opposite. And I think that might have played a huge role in why I felt so much pressure to be above and beyond, and so much so that it ended up backfiring and hurting me and hurting my family. You know, in that piece, The Good Dad, that published in Slate, where I talk about this, I interviewed a psychotherapist. His name is Justin Leoi, and he specializes in treatment for men. And so he gets a lot of new fathers. And one of the things that he shared with me was that a lot of these men, when they're holding their baby, it's often the first baby they've ever held in their lives. And they don't have that same relationship to fatherhood as a mother does to motherhood. So one of the things that he shared with me was that one of his patients resented his dad and told himself that he was going to be the opposite. And that, in fact, that was something that he heard a lot, that they wanted to just be different from their dads. And so they often felt like they were trying to rechart and reinvent the idea for what a dad is. And when you're starting from scratch, it makes sense that not everybody's version will play out perfectly. And maybe I felt that same way too. Like, I did need to invent what a good dad was. Maybe that's why I felt like I needed to read all the baby books. And when I was trying to reach out to other people, maybe they didn't know that I needed that support because they themselves are on their own path and they're figuring out things for themselves. And that's why I was so grateful for the subreddit Dadit, because that was the first place I've ever seen dads be really vulnerable and ask questions like, I didn't cry when my baby was born. Does that make me a bad father? You know, like things like that, that really logically don't make sense. And to a mom, that's going to not, it's going to sound crazy, but for dads, it kind of takes this very visceral place in your chest where it just feels real and you can't shake it. And you might feel a little embarrassed, and it festers and it grows. And then it turns into these performances of masculinity where you end up wanting to project yourself as being the overly great father who's going to be taking care of everything. You know, and sometimes, in my case at least, it could tremendously backfire.
That was Eamon Ismail, who is staff writer at Slate. All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow.